Let's go back to 1 Timothy 3, if you would. And I mentioned the distinction of shepherding and service. And I want to highlight, to go back to the two biblical offices of pastors and deacons, there are similarities in the qualifications that we find in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 15. And I want to highlight some of those for you, okay? In other words, there's a lot of similarities on these lists of qualifications when you look at a pastor and a deacon, to the point that you might look at it and go, are we talking about the same person? And that's a good question because there's a lot of similarities, but we're not talking about the same person or same office. We're talking about two separate offices. So that's why it's important, though, to highlight the similarities and why there are similarities to the two offices. So I want to give you five similar qualifications between the two offices. All right? Number one is a blameless reputation. If you look down in verse 2, now the overseer is to be above reproach. That means above accusation. It doesn't mean we live perfectly, far from it. But it's that we have a reputation enough so that if an accusation came against us, it would be hard to prove because our life consistently is showing to be above blame in regard to what that might be. Above reproach. And that's what also described as a deacon, if you notice that. Is also listed as to be above reproach, above blame. That would make sense that both of those would be included in these two offices. They're leading in different aspects of the church. But that's why there's also a mention of verse 6. For the pastor, he must not be a recent convert, or he may not become conceited and fall into the same judgment of the devil. He must also have a good reputation with outsiders so that he will not fall into disgrace into the devil's trap. So it makes sense, the two main offices, the two leaders of a congregation would be described in that way because pastors are leading and have authority and making decisions. Deacons would be serving and leading in service, probably handling money and resources and those kinds of things. It would make sense that the qualification would be to be above reproach. So pastor I mentor who pastors in Hawaii, and he took a Baptist church there. And when he got there, he calls me and he describes to me what he walked into. And one of the things he walked into was the treasurer of the church before he got there embezzled $1 million from the church. And I said, did you say $1 million? And he begun to just try to pick up the pieces. Well, so imagine what that did in that community, this church. And one of the leaders embezzled $1 million. And it was, there was a lawsuit. It was public. It was on the news. I mean, it doesn't take much. All it takes is something like that to go, okay, yeah, I get why this would probably be part of the qualification of a pastor or a deacon. A blameless reputation. Number two, manager of home. Manager of home. We see that in the pastor. Verse 4. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him, and he must do so in a manner worthy of full respect. Verse 5, it's the only reason given in one of these qualifications. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how will he take care of God's church? Which, by the way, pastors, creates a prerequisite to manage our family well to even qualify to be a pastor. So the reasoning there in verse 5 is particularly important when that qualification in verse 4 is listed there. But for the deacon, there's also a similar kind of description here with deacons to manage verse 12. A deacon must be faithful to his wife and must manage his children and his household well. So blameless reputation, but then also you have to show to manage your home as given at least for the pastor, because if you can't manage your home, how are you going to manage the church? It's a prerequisite to qualify for these offices. A similar qualification, number 3, is godly character. And if you just scan the verses, you see godly character, and a fourth one is spiritual maturity. So I'll just put those together. Godly character and spiritual maturity. Most of this list, if we read through it, is, you know, verse 2, you know, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable. Verse 3, not given to drunkenness, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. I mean, this, you go down to deacons, it's the same thing. Verse 8, worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in much wine, not pursuing dishonest gain, and it just goes on. So godly character and spiritual maturity is highlighted for both offices. And I assume that would be pretty much common sense for us on why those would exist for a pastor or a deacon who would be serving in the church. Finally, number 5, a similar qualification that is not necessarily highlighted in this text, but I want to highlight anyways, it's elsewhere. And that is plurality. The consistent theme in the New Testament is the plurality of elders and the plurality of deacons. In other words, there needs to be more than one. And if you look through the New Testament consistently, unless it's a passage that is describing one elder or one deacon, like right here, what Paul's doing with Timothy, every place else, it's used in the plural. And Paul writes to the churches. He'll write and address the elders and the deacons. I mean, speaking to the Ephesian elders, he speaks in the plural there. It's just all over the place that it's in the plural, with deacons as well. And so I just want to put that out there, that a similar qualification is the biblical model, I believe. Feel free to push back in the Q&A, is plurality. It's clear in the texts that we look at. But I also want to make a practical argument for that. I believe the work of being a pastor and the work of being a deacon, if we do it well, is way too much for one person to carry. You all who are solo pastors, you're the only one shepherding. You're the only pastor in the church. I just want to send my sympathy and burden to you. I know what that's like. I was in that situation for years. And I know that it's too much to carry, and you know it's too much to carry, which is why it's not a good plan long term. The goal is to try to have at least someone helping you carry that burden and load of shepherding, which is why, if you're like me, you don't have a bunch of money to hire a bunch of other pastors. So how do we even find lay leaders that may not even qualify to be an elder? But how do we find a lay leader who maybe has gifts to help shepherd people? And they can be the help to you, even if you don't have someone who could qualify as an elder. Again, that's why I want us to see the category and the trickle down of who could serve in that capacity. So those are the 5 similar qualifications between pastors and deacons. Assume those aren't going to be too debated. What is debated is what's the differences. What's the difference between a pastor and a deacon? 3 main differences that we find in the New Testament. The first one we find in 1 Timothy 3. Is teaching versus well-taught. Teaching versus well-taught. In the midst of all the similarities, there's one glaring difference in verse 2 of 1 Timothy 3. At the very end of 2, an overseer is to be above reproach, faithful to his wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach. That right there is one of the main differences between a pastor and a deacon. There is no part of the qualification of deacon, if we look in that section, that talks about him being have to be able to teach. Now, if you have a deacon that can teach the word faithfully, praise God for that. Let him teach. That's wonderful. You can have a deacon that teaches, by the way. I get that question like, well, can a deacon? Well, of course a deacon can teach. Sure, if he's gifted to teach. He doesn't have to be able to teach, though, to be a deacon. That's the difference. To be an elder, you have to be able to teach. Now, there's different ways to define that, and we can talk about that in Q&A if you want. But the qualification for a pastor is to be able to teach, and that makes sense because the pastors are the doctrinal gatekeepers of the gospel. We're to guard the deposit that Paul tells Timothy and to entrust it to other faithful men. That That's the call for a pastor. We preach and teach the word. Naturally, we need to be able to handle the word. Paul writes to Timothy and says this about pastors, elders. We've got to be able to exhort in sound doctrine and refute those who contradict it. So not just be able to exhort, but actually be able to know the word and to be skilled in that enough to be able to refute those who contradict it. And then the second half of Titus chapter 1 is him describing the rebellious men the pastors are to protect the church from. So it's both. And pastors are called to that work, not deacons. Therefore, able to teach, just a few short words, has a profound meaning in these qualifications. So teaching versus well taught. But deacons should be well taught. If you scan through this, a deacon must be faithful to his wife. Let me see where I'm. Verse 13, I believe. Those who have served well gain an excellent standing and great assurance of the faith in Christ Jesus. Verse 11. In the same way, the women are to be worthy of respect and not malicious talkers, but temperate and trustworthy in everything. Verse 10, deacons must be first tested, and then if there's nothing against them, let them serve as deacons. There's this kind of idea of godly character and quality that exists. There's like implied spiritual maturity that comes from a knowledge of the word, but there's not have to be an ability to be able to teach it like pastors. So that's the first distinction. Distinction number two, oversight versus service. Oversight versus service. I'll just reference, we'll turn back there, but first Peter 5 again. Do you remember what Peter said there in regard to oversight? Verse 2, be shepherds of God's flock that are under your care, watching over them. Other translations will actually say oversight, exercising oversight. Pastors are to have oversight over everything that happens in the church. Imagine an umbrella that covers all of the church. And there's all kinds of different roles that pastors play under that umbrella. But they are to have oversight over everything, which means they can't do everything. But everything that happens in the church on their watch, they are responsible for. That's, by the way, what comes with the authority that pastors are given. So if something happens in your church, even though you didn't do it, if it happens under your oversight, we need to take responsibility for it. That's part of what this call is. That is not the call of deacons. The essence of the word deacon is service. But they are to lead in service, so they're leaders in the church. This is where it gets tricky on how do then pastors relate to deacons in that way. Well, pastors are the ones that have the oversight. Oversight versus service. That is a really important distinction between the two roles. So even though there may be deacons who serve and lead in service and even are telling people what to do in the midst of that service they do, it's all under the oversight of pastors. The pastors still have the oversight, which is why the question this brother asked earlier, if pastors have the oversight, trustees who can sign, sell property and sign documents and all, it's still under their oversight. So that is a very important distinction here. And what happens in a lot of churches, it was in mine, I get hired as the pastor to preach and go visit people and they don't want to make me any decisions. That oversight pastors have and the deacons are within that oversight, all of a sudden it did that. By the way, about for 30 years before I got there. You know how it happened? Pastors came and went every 2 to 3 years, every 2 to 3 years, every 2 to 3 years. And slowly over 30 years, this happened. And the deacons all of a sudden have the oversight and they have the authority. And the pastors, this hired hand who preaches and visits people. And that's probably how it happened in your church. It didn't happen over 2 years or 3 years. It happens over decades, long before you probably got there. And that's really important to know, because if you figure out why that happened in your church, it helps give you a path forward to know how to try to move it back. Oversight versus service. There's more evidence that pastors have oversight than necessarily deacons. We don't get as much evidence of that service idea, though we get some. I don't think Acts 6 is talking about the first pastors and deacons of the church, of the early church. I do think it is a paradigm that Paul later sets up. So I do think those seven men that are raised up in Acts 6 to go serve the tables and serve the widows who need to be cared for is definitely a model of what deacons are supposed to be doing eventually when they're established. So oversight versus service. Number three, third distinction. The third distinction, shepherding versus what I call practical doing. Shepherding versus practical doing. Again, according to 1 Peter chapter 5, the main task of a pastor, shepherd the flock of God. That's the imperative. And then the very first thing he says on how to do that, you exercise oversight. But deacons are called not to have oversight or even to shepherd in that way, but to practically meet needs in the church. So deacons serve. And one of the main aspects of service that every one of our churches needs is to somehow address the physical needs of the church. Now, it's all running together. I can't remember if somebody asked the question in the Q&A or somebody said something to me afterwards. But somebody asked is there crossover? Do you want the deacons to not shepherd at all? Do elders then not have to serve in any way? Well, of course there's going to be crossover. It's about what is your primary role. And here's one of the examples I give to say that, yeah, there should just be organic ministry and care that is extended, but what is your primary task? So here's the example I like to give. There is a widow in the church, and the pastors and the deacons want to care well for this widow. And this widow has a plumbing issue in her house, and she can't fix it. And the deacons are the ones that come and try to help her with that house issue in her. And they're the ones, they either come fix it or they bring the repair guy with them, but they take charge of caring for that physical need that that widow has. But those men, that group of men, whoever it was that went, they failed in their task if they just come and fix the plumbing issue and not say, by the way, how are you? Can I pray for you before I go? What's that? Well, that's shepherding, but that's not their primary task. But that's just Christian love and being mindful that you're caring for people's souls. Likewise, that elder that goes to care for the widow and he sits down with her and asks how she's doing and trying to care for her. She's recently had some suffering in her life. He's sitting down just asking how she's doing. He's talking to her. He reads scripture. He wants to pray with her. He's trying to figure out maybe how he can care for her soul and how she's wrestling with things with the Lord. And they sit in the living room for 45 minutes having that conversation because that's what shepherding is. But that elder has failed in his task. If he's at this widow's home, who's physically frail, and before he leaves, he doesn't look at her and say, by the way, while I'm here, you need me to do anything for you? You need me to lift something? You need me to carry something for you that you can't carry? You need me to... He's failed if he doesn't just figure out how to care for some basic needs. That's a service role. That's what deacons do. But the goal is to care well for people and to know our primary role. So when we talk about the distinctions, the goal is not to just separate everything completely, but it's to know what our primary role is. And to one of the questions asked earlier, that's when a group of deacons and a group of pastor elders understand what their role is and they stay in their lane and they work together, it is a incredibly beautiful thing to see. And churches thrive in it. I went from solo pastor, deep plurality of deacons who were pseudo elders that had done this to the biblical model. And within 7 to 8 years, we had done this. And for the next 8-9 years, that biblical polity that we had set up thrived in incredible ways. But those deacons have to understand their role and embrace it, as well as the pastors have to understand their role and embrace it. And what that practically looks like, we can flesh out at some point. But that is an important distinction. Deacons, in the fact that they're in service, you need to think almost physical needs. What are the physical needs that need to be met by the church? And that's primarily where I think the service side of deacons would fall. What we're going to get into, God willing, tomorrow morning is we're going to get into the logistics of that. What are some of the things to think of? What are the categories of shepherding that not just elders do, but then other lay leaders can be equipped to do? And same with deacons. What are areas of service? What's the lane for deacons? So tomorrow we're going to flesh out what are the two lanes of these two areas of shepherding and service. And I have a confidence that by the end of that, you will have the categories that any aspect of service or shepherding you would have in your church would fall under one of those categories. That's the plan, if I can bait you to come back tomorrow. That's what we're going to talk about, all right? But these are the distinctions, okay? Teaching versus well-taught, oversight versus service, and then shepherding versus practical doing. Realizing there's going to be some crossover, but ultimately we need to know what our individual roles are. Okay, I'm going to stop there again. Let's get some feedback from you. Let's go back to some questions. And by the way, I'm hitting some just basic ideas, and I want the question time to be able to flesh out some of the things you specifically want to talk about in this regard. Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Could you just say a little bit about how women fit into this? So I work for the church. I'm paid by the church.
Yes.
How would that fit into the...
Yeah, thank you for asking. Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I believe that women can take the category of deacon if there's elders. So I'm a commentarian, so I would hold to men as elders, but if there are male elders, that women can definitely play deacon roles and lead and serve in that way. Women's workers that play staff roles, and I think that's a wonderful model for women who feel a call either to want to be a part of shepherding people or want to serve in some way. I think that's a wonderful way for church staffs to be shaped and those kind of things. I had a woman on staff with me at our church that we actually couldn't pay. She and her husband lived in one of the houses that the church owned. And that was kind of part of the compensation that we had. And I mean, she was like a right-hand person to me. She was such a huge blessing and served the church on staff, was a director of all kinds of different ministries that most people served in. I mean, she was one of the main leaders in the church. So, yeah, I think, I mean, outside of not wanting to give women the title of an elder, I think all of us as church leaders need to figure out how women can be celebrated and equipped and to in whatever way we can to allow them to thrive. I think a lot of churches have failed to do that. And I think that's one of the ways to do it. So the women's ministry worker is more prevalent here than it is back home. I think it's a model that actually, I think you all here in Britain do better than Americans do in trying to just equip women in different ways to be able to serve. And then I think it's just for any women can serve in any kind of capacity in that way. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So just, it's a question about this distinction between shepherding and practical doing. There's a few components to it. The first would be what biblical evidence you see. Obviously, elders or pastors shepherding is pretty clear, but outside of Acts 6, so in Acts 6, I can see the kind of practical distinction. But like, is there any other biblical evidence that deacons is a specifically practical role? I guess in the context we're in, we've tried to acknowledge both elders and deacons as leadership roles within the church. So we then have been using the deacon role for people who lead in other ways. So if the elders are the big umbrella, I guess anyone who's got a small umbrella underneath that is leading in an area specific. But for us at the moment, that would include both practical roles and, say, someone who's running a ministry team, you know, maybe a team working with refugees and asylum seekers running a Bible study during the week. They're, you know, so the former pastor, who's obviously qualified to be an elder, is at the moment a deacon because he's not taking the big umbrella role, he's leading in a specific area. But I would say I wouldn't call that practical because he's largely doing word ministry. I just have, yeah, that's the question really about where you see in the Bible that clear demarcation that deacons is practical work.
Yeah, thank you. Good question. So I think there's less evidence in the New Testament on what deacons actually do. There's more evidence of what pastors and elders do. And I think by just default, because we have more evidence that what pastors do, they shepherd, that's their calling, and they also are given authority. What I don't see in the New Testament is I don't see deacons shepherding, and I don't see deacons with authority outside of the elders. So it's more of an indirect evaluation of that. The practical doing part is, and again, it's service, which you could categorize what you're talking about as service as well as a deacon. I'm trying to just bring the contrast. What's the opposite of shepherding? I mean, shepherding is really categorized as the care of souls, and that's a spiritual work. So that's the task of pastors. And so I think Acts 6 does give us at least a little bit of a framework on how that maybe worked. But yeah, there's not a ton. It's more of what are the clarity of what pastors are supposed to do kind of helps us draw inference on what deacons should be doing. And so that's just a way to kind of draw the contrast out of what are the tasks in the church that aren't shepherding but needs to be done? And a lot of it's going to be meeting the practical needs. But I do point to that Acts 6 example of what a lot of deacons can and should be doing. There's not a ton other than that I'm aware of. Yeah. Which is why this could vary in how it's applied, certainly. Yes.
Yeah, so one of the roles of an elder is to be able to teach. Yeah. What setting would that be in? I mean, is it able to preach, or is it able to teach in other settings? And if you've got a deacon that is able to teach in other settings other than preaching, does that mean they're therefore qualified for eldership, even if they can't preach? If we would agree that they don't have to be able to preach but can teach in other settings?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a lot of disagreement around this, and I don't think that's clear. I think like some would say that the able to teach is the requirement is some kind of public ministry of the word. Others would say, no, able to teach means he needs to be able to teach. He may not be a great preacher, but he can sit and lead a small group Bible study. Or even he's a great discipler one-on-one across the table from somebody. I know churches that use that as the qualification, and so they'll make somebody an elder who's got some really wonderful shepherding gifts, maybe not a great, public ability to preach, but he's able to teach. And he's got so many strong shepherding gifts that they'll make him an elder in light of that. Because there's obviously other qualifications other than just being able to teach. So in our church, because this is one of the places we were very wealthy in, we were average sized church, no money, but we had a pretty deep bench when it came to guys who could preach and teach and had real gifts there. I think because of that, all of our elders always had public ministry gifts with the word. But I don't think that's a requirement everywhere. And by the way, I would even encourage a church that doesn't have a lot of people to choose from, but you want to try to have elders that in some way. I think that's something seriously to consider can they handle the word? Could they explain it to somebody across the table drinking tea? On what the word is in a one-on-one discipleship. I think that can qualify. I think it just depends on the church. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Do you mind if we go back to the subject of women's ministry?
Yeah, sure.
So women's ministry certainly in our church, and I guess in many of our churches, is really word-based. It's discipleship. It's doing Bible studies. It's not particularly practical, although I guess that comes into it. It feels much more like an elder role that you're describing.
Okay.
But as a complementarian, I'm wondering how you put that together.
Well, I mean, I think it depends on the context of each of our churches and how we would apply that. So, I mean, so the most recent reference I have is how I saw women leading at the FIC conference this week. I think I said it to Adrian or somebody else, but I just looked over this. For Rachel to lead with you is really a great idea, because I think it's important. I think it's totally appropriate for Rachel to have led like that. That's my person, and I'm a complementarian. But again, I think in America, this becomes a really, I think it becomes a sensitive issue to where, well, I'll just say in my tribe of churches, let me speak out of that. So that's my context. There are male pastors who are trying to be so careful about this that we've done a terrible job equipping women and putting them in positions to minister in ways I think they can and should. It's part of my own even personal story in that I had a lot of men to train for the ministry in our church for years, and that's what I was doing. And I woke up one day in our church and realized I had all these gifted, capable women with public ministry gifts that I actually had done a terrible job of equipping and even positioning to minister in our church. It wasn't because I was necessarily trying to hold them back, but I was just busy training men to be pastors because that's kind of where I put my energy. And I'm thankful it wasn't until two or three women in our church who are strong, opinionated women, public gifts public ministry gifts, who kind of came and pushed me on this in a way that I'm like, and I found I didn't have a good answer, and I realized I had failed at this. And God used them to help me kind of think about, okay, how can I equip women who feel gifted to minister in different ways? And so one of the implications of that is I'd say for my last 6-7 years at the church, we had a woman who led all the music and leadership and all the people who served in that role in that ministry. But she was publicly leading music all the time. I mean, like in a similar way the band did this week, where there's both a man and a woman leading in different ways. But we had a woman that led and just was incredibly gifted and blessed our church. And she led. I mean, she led. She was reading scripture. She was exhorting in the public gathering. But she didn't preach. And she didn't, do the things that we would clearly say, this is an elder role. So I do think that does vary depending on what a church sees as an elder role. And so that's why I wouldn't say do this, not this, and do this. I think every church is different. You want to show clarity that whatever an elder role is in the church, the men need to do that. What I found is that as I was pushed on this and started reading scripture and praying and thinking about how to really help women thrive in my church as leaders, that I wasn't doing as good a job as I thought. And I made some pivots and adjustments around that. Does that help? Okay. Yeah.
Sorry. Thank you. My apologies if this question isn't quite as clear as I'd like it to be. We talked about the authority of scripture. And elders, our authority as elders is only as far as scripture goes. So I can't command my people to do stuff that scripture doesn't command. And one of the principal ways that elders lead and exercise their authority is through preaching. What about people who might be gifted to preach, but who are not elders? Maybe they might be qualified one day and you're kind of training them, or maybe actually they're not, but they have the gifts. What would you do in terms of who you would ask to preach?
Well, good question. If somebody has the gift to preach and has gifts to preach and teach, that's a wonderful way to serve the church. So I'm gonna equip them to do that, whether they become an elder or not. So the distinction is not whether they will become an elder, but now if they could not qualify as an elder, or there's something in their life that would prevent that, I'm going to probably be mindful of that, depending on how much I would ask them to do those things. But, I hope you all have people who teach Sunday school in your church that have the gift to teach, who might not ever become an elder in your church, but they have the gift to teach, and they're using that and exercising that. That's why, again, where we're going with this is I want to really put these categories in your head of shepherding and service. Shepherding is word-based. Is that the word, ministry of the word, is going to fall under shepherding. But that doesn't mean it has to be an elder. There's going to be people who can serve in that category. I would put those kind of guys in that category. The last thing I'll say is, again, I was very committed to raising people up for the ministry and sending them out, men and women. So I sent... I sent single women to really dangerous countries to be missionaries because God called them, and I wanted to support them in that. And when we set up a support system to be able to do that, but so I want to train men and women for ministry. And the only way to prepare a man to be a pastor is he's got to be able to preach. You got to help him develop those gifts. And he's going to hope the best place to do that is to do that in the church. One of the ways we did that is they typically preached on Sunday evening, not Sunday morning. Some of them would eventually. But when you're training somebody even to help them learn to preach, there's ways to provide that opportunity for them to be able to do that. But if you're going to be about training people for the ministry, and part of their ministry would be a public ministry of the word, where else are they going to get that experience and then to do it in the local church? So I think that's important to build into the preaching schedule. Yeah.
Sorry, this isn't a small topic to raise, and you probably won't thank me for it. But the whole thing of reputation, obviously it's critical bringing people in to office, as either as elders or as deacons. When things go awry, when people are in ministry, and obviously there can be a spectrum, there can be your million-pound embezzlement, consorting with prostitutes, or something like, this happened on my watch, failure to act properly in a case of domestic abuse or child abuse or something like that.
Yeah.
Is reputational damage a one-way ticket out? How do we balance restorative grace with people's long memories and Google searches? it's a tough thing, but yeah. Where do you stand on those issues?
I appreciate you asking that question, because that's obviously getting thrown around a lot these days, especially with some pretty spectacular celebrity falls in the last few years. I would say that it's case by case, but in most cases, if a sin is committed by a pastor that would demand that he need to step down, even temporarily, that at least needs to happen, and a restorative work needs to be done with him to, to determine whether what depending on what happened, is this something that can that he can enter in back into the ministry. I think that's case by case, but yeah, I do think there's circumstances that would require someone to step down temporarily. When I say temporarily, like years, not months, but like years to be able to establish. Because I think the above reproach qualification that we find here doesn't get resolved in 6 months, And so I think there can be restoration even back into the ministry, but I think it takes years. I also think there are certain things that a pastor could do that would be a permanent disqualification. I would say 10 years ago, I probably had a larger list of what the permanent disqualification would be than I probably would say now. Maybe it's just because I work with a lot of just pastors are broken and messy and they make mistakes and they fail. And but Jesus is about redeeming us, even in our biggest failures and mistakes and sins. And so that list is smaller now, but it still exists. So I hate to say, so this and this is permanent and everything else is okay. I would hesitate to put those kind of categories in there, but the guy that embezzled $1 million, he's probably done. How about that? We'll start there. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Brian. It's causing me to think about a few things, and that the kind of definition that you've made of shepherding using the word and deacons serving in kind of practical ways. Just thinking in terms of our church, like new people come in and, actually it would be really good to have someone head up, like looking after those new people and sort of welcoming and catering and all those type of things. But then in the qualifications of elders and deacons, hospitality is for elders and not for deacons. Do I need to reassess kind of what hospitality is? Probably. But also like how, because that's not a word thing, but it is a calling on elders. So how do you fit that together in terms of that shepherding, serving thing?
Yeah, I think if I'm following you, I'll answer it this way. Yeah, I think it does matter. If you think of what hospitality is, okay, it's at least, you being hospitable the technical definition, if I remember, is hospitality, being hospitable to strangers, actually, is the meaning of. But I would also put out there that there's just there's an understanding of pastors needing to be hospitable, just welcoming to people. I think that could be in our homes. I think it could be even just being willing and welcome to meet with people, and even in the church, you know, his office or whatever it might be. I think all that could be covered in that. The reason I would say I think hospitality is there for the pastor and not necessarily for a deacon is because the pastor's role is one of caring for souls and spiritual. And that in a way that deacons aren't necessarily called, I think, to that role. So the implication of the opportunities to be able to spiritually care for people's souls, to minister the word in private, would take place in a hospitable environment like that. That's my best guess at it. Yeah.
Hi, Brian.
Hey.
I wondered if you were able to share any lessons learned relating to selection and appointment of deacons.
Selection and appointment of deacons? Yeah. So once we got things on track, like once we got pastors in place that knew what their role is and deacons in place who knew what their role was, then we ended up going through a process of affirmation and ordination together. So we would go through a process when the people were ready. We had a couple people to make deacons or one or two person become an elder. We walked through as elders and deacons, we walked through like deacons would bring us people they thought that we should maybe consider as deacons. And then the elders considered that, but that came from the deacons because they're doing the work of service and we wanted to honor their thoughts on that. But then we would determine as elders that if we wanted to pursue somebody, and then we would actually talk to people in private. Those people, are you interested in this? You know, this is what it's about. And we would begin that process privately long before we ever brought it. But we kind of learned this the hard way too, that you take something public too soon and then you have to pull it off the table. It can be a pretty painful process. So I kind of followed the path of the elders and for deacons, the deacons as well. We almost all needed to be in just full agreement on the individual before we then took it to the church. But we're elder-led congregational. So we would take it to the church and say, hey, well, we're going to begin a process to move towards potential affirmation and ordination of this man for an elder. So then we set up a 3-month process with the church that walked through several members meetings where we talked publicly about the person. People asked questions. People could approach us in private. That would eventually lead to a full, just a vote and affirmation by the congregation of that person we put forward as an elder, that person we put forward as a deacon. And then when that would happen, we would do a formal service together, usually on a Sunday morning. And that was, we did it publicly on Sunday morning. And we're talking maybe once every, 12, 18 months this would happen. But we did it on Sunday morning as an opportunity, one, to celebrate putting these people in place. But it was also a moment every time to teach on the differences between pastors and deacons. That was such a big part of the history of the church. I wanted to make sure we continued to put that in front of people. All the way down to where they're agreeing to vows they're making to the church. The church is making vows to them. It was very meaningful. Some of the most meaningful services I've ever been a part of. And made it a big deal. And then everybody knew who the deacons and pastors were as a result of that. So, yeah. Yeah.
Can you speak into the pros and cons of appointing people as deacons who are doing roles which go beyond the bounds of the church? So I know in some traditions, for example, say somebody is running a mercy ministry in a town, which is a cross-wide thing. Maybe it's involving other churches.
Yeah.
I suppose that in a world of parachurch organizations and also, other things, in my tradition, it's not a strong point to appoint people as deacons. So I can think of someone in our congregation who works for a missionary organization. He would be qualified as a deacon, and he's kind of doing a diaconal role.
Yeah.
But we've not appointed him in that formal way.
Yeah.
But is that an example of the church abstaining their responsibility, if you see what I mean, for being at the heart of those type of activities?
Yeah.
Or does it just introduce a messiness in church life if you start kind of getting involved in everyone else's affairs? Could you just speak into that?
Sure. So first thing I would say is ultimately you want the functionality of these two offices. You want people shepherding and serving. So even if you can't call them the name you want to call them, the functionality is where the true benefit is for the church. And by the way, I say that because I know tons of guys who like maybe read a couple books on this and they geek out about it and all they do is think about trying to call it the right thing or change their bylaws and it functionally doesn't do anything. So the functionality is what you want and go from there. But I would just say, like, I mean, in plain reading, there's pastors, there's deacons as the two offices. Most everybody, even within church history, whether regardless of what they called them, agreed those are two main offices of the church with the two distinct roles that they have. So, I mean, I just encourage everybody to figure out, you know, what do you need to do to, I mean, since the terminology is so plain, yeah, I think, is it worth a conversation about? I know church plants in the States that worked so hard to get elders that all of a sudden they woke up like 5-6 years into their church plant and they're talking to me and I said, so who are your deacons? And they're like, oh, we don't have deacons. And I said, why don't you have deacons? And they had never realized that they didn't have deacons. They worked so hard at getting elders. They didn't have deacons. And that actually really sprung them into, man, we need to figure out deacons. It's in the Bible. So I think it's a matter first of functionality, but then just, yeah, figure out, is there a change you got to make? Is this worth kind of trying to figure out as far as proper terminology to understand the role? Last thing I'll say is, if he's already playing a deacon role and he's doing mission stuff in the community and all that kind of stuff, I mean, the role of deacon is for that local church, I believe. So if he's primarily doing stuff like that kind of work, but it's outside the church, I'm not sure it's worth giving him a deacon distinction. So just give him another snazzy title.